Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
38 riots in cities all across the country, dozens of African Americans killed, mostly by whites who attacked African American communities. It was called the Red Summer, and that term was coined by James Weldon Johnson, who was working for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People as a field secretary at the time. Our next guest argues that the true beginning of the civil rights movement was that red hot summer of 1919, and it's the title of his new book, Red Summer, by Cameron McWhirter. Cameron joins us from our affiliate station, WEAA, in Baltimore. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
You know, this summer of 1919, it seemed to be the confluence of a lot of different things. Not only the return of a lot of African-American soldiers who'd fought in World War One, but also going on at this point, there were terrible labor shortages in the North. So many African-Americans through the Great Migration were moving north, which left for a lot of resentment down in the South. And there was a Red Scare going on, making the United States populace suspicious of anything that was a strike or labor unrest or any kind of things that could be labeled as radical views.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And it was compounded by politicians who didn't act when they should have, by politicians who were racist, by a very young J. Edgar Hoover, who was working for the Attorney General at the time. And he certainly conflated black activism and black political activity with radical movements. And this just obviously cascaded well into the 1960s, as you know.
Well, and as we know, there was race riots in more than three dozen American cities. And in three, one of the things that set this violence apart, because unfortunately, there's a lot of incidences of race violence in the United States. But one of the things that occurred here is that in three places, black communities fought back, and that hadn't really been seen before.
Yeah, well, black people had obviously been dealing with race riots since the beginning of the Republic, since before the beginning of the Republic. But the in Chicago and Washington, D.C., particularly that year, those were two major riots which most people aren't aware of. Black people defended their neighborhoods and fought back very fiercely in the streets. And that shocked and horrified a lot of white Americans and really established, I argue, black political activism and a black political movement in this country.
And unfortunately, those cities, which Chicago, D.C., and in Arkansas, that's where the greatest number of fatalities occurred as well.
Correct. D.C., nobody really knows how many people were killed because the federal government refused to investigate it. So we have no idea really what happened. We know there was a lot of carnage, and it went on for days longer than it needed to.
Well, the civil rights as a political movement, as you say, Cameron McWhirter, 1919 is a really important year. And I'm struck by W.E.B. Du Bois wrote this astounding piece called Returning Soldiers, The Crisis, in May of 1919, as this unrest was beginning to unfold. And he talked about the impact of what those soldiers had seen in Europe versus what they were experiencing in the United States. And he predicted a cultural clash that, in fact, came true.
Yeah, the book obviously has a lot of very ugly aspects where we go into all the riots and lynchings, but also I think it's a very positive book in the sense that as I researched this book, I became very, very proud of Americans who happen to be black who stood up for the Constitution of the United States of America. And I think W. Du Bois is a classic example. He was absolutely hitting his stride in terms of what he was writing at that time. James Weldon Johnson was a dynamo. Walter White, who was in his mid-20s, was risking his life to investigate riots and lynchings. And these three men really transformed the NAACP from what had been a sort of dowdy, white, do-gooder-run organization into a powerful black organization.
We're speaking with the author of the new book, Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America. Cameron McWhirter joins us. But what were the sparks here? What were the final straws that broke the camel's back, both in inciting this race violence and in prompting some of these black communities to organize?
Well, you mentioned the soldiers coming back. That was a huge factor. African-American soldiers had gone to France and had been treated incredibly well by the French people because they were thrilled. People were coming to defend their country. When they returned, they found themselves facing the same prejudices and Jim Crow restrictions that they had faced earlier. Secondly, as you pointed out, the Great Migration gathered great steam during World War I because you needed, northern industry needed workers, and they couldn't get immigrants because of the war. So black people began moving north in droves, and that caused lots of friction because many of those workers were non-unionized, and unionized workers in the cities obviously resented that. And then lastly, you had farmers in the South, sharecroppers, the quintessentially downtrodden group, were suddenly making a lot of money in 1919 because of an enormous spike in commodity prices, particularly cotton. So suddenly, the sharecropper who never had any money suddenly could buy cars, they were buying land, and that caused intense friction.
So what came next in these decades that followed between the summer of 1919 and the real civil rights movement, the huge effort that came with Martin Luther King and all the other activists? What were the decades in between in that buildup?
Well, there's tons and tons. There's other books that have been written about what happened during World War II, and there was certainly a lot of effort. Efforts, and by no means was 1919 the end solving of all our racial problems by any means.
Solving of lynching, for that matter.
Right. But lynching decreased. From that year on, lynching decreased every year. And as I point out in the book, for example, Emmett Till was killed in the 1950s, a horrible case. He was killed in the middle of the night by a handful of people who swore themselves to secrecy. A horrible crime, no doubt. But in 1919, in Ellisville, Mississippi, a man named John Hartfield was executed in front of 10,000 people in broad daylight, and his body was cut up into pieces and sold as souvenirs.
And
the governor defended it.
But in some cases, I think your book also lays out the fact that in some cases, cities felt powerless to intervene in some of this violence, and that may actually have spurred a few public policy changes.
Yes, and obviously, by the time the civil rights movement evolved, President Eisenhower and later President Kennedy and President Johnson all intervened with federal authority in various cases to promote civil rights. And this was being screamed about by the NAACP in 1919. When that man was executed that I mentioned, the NAACP requested the federal government to intervene. They rejected it. Woodrow Wilson perpetually said, we can't get involved. It's a state matter. That changed dramatically in the coming decades.
So you say that this book, although it's describing the summer of 1919 when race riots killed dozens of African Americans, you say that in the end it's a hopeful message.
Yes, it was the birth of the civil rights movement.
Cameron McWhirter, you can't get it more simple than that. Author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America, joined us via our affiliate station WEAA in Baltimore. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The importance of 1919. A different discussion of ethics, though, this morning on the program. The phone hacking scandal at News Corp, which is now before the British Parliament, taking place this morning. We asked you, is ethics and profit a difficult combination in the corporate media world? From Winchester, Massachusetts, one person who reached us by texting the word TAKE to 69866 wrote this: I think that as long as you put clients' needs first, profits will always come. Maybe not as fast as you would like, but you will always make out. Our rule at our small insurance business is what's right for the client is what's right for us. But who is the client in the news business? That's the interesting question there. Tell us your golden rules for business behavior. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can text the word TAKE, as our listener from Winchester did, 69866. Don't forget, you can listen to any of the stories you missed today by going to thetakeaway.org, or just follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @TheTakeaway.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.